It is the Craig Needles Podcast and is brought to you by our friends over at Lexus of London. And I want to talk about, in a special episode, we typically don't do Thursdays, but I wanted to make sure we had a fulsome conversation about Bill 23, which is something you've probably seen on the internet. It's something you've very likely seen at various conversations, be it at London City Hall or basically any other city hall across the province, where politicians are essentially saying, hey, this is a very bad idea, with the exception, of course, of people within the Progressive Conservative government. I wanted to ask AJ Ray about this, who is a PhD candidate in the Department of Geography and Environment at Western University, and was kind enough to come in studio and join us today to talk about Bill 23 and the housing implications here in the province of Ontario. AJ, thank you very much for doing this. I appreciate the time.
Thanks very much, Craig, for having me on. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
So let's first talk about Bill 23 and what it is. And I mentioned that it has become deeply unpopular. And at London City Hall, you had a 15-0 vote telling the province, hey, maybe you should reconsider this. And I know people are going to say, well, that's an ideological thing and they're mad at conservatives or whatever. Paul Van Meerbergen, last I checked, pretty conservative guy. He was among the ones saying, well, this is probably a bad idea. So clearly, all over the political spectrum among councillors, there is some distaste for Bill 23. Yet at the same time, the province continues to sort of put their heads down and go forward with it. What are your thoughts on the way that this has been looked at or discussed by municipalities relative to how they say it's going to create some big holes in their budget?
Well, I think you've identified one of the core differences here with this bill. Typically, we see at the municipal level a division between progressives and conservatives at the council table on what the province or the federal government is choosing to do. In this case, we really have a situation that these local governments and these local councillors are concerned about what they're going to have to tell their constituents now that sort of revenue tools are being pulled away. We've changed provisions of the Planning Act, what can be considered in a development application. And I think that's where Bill 23 has really created this divide between the province and the province wanting more housing built faster, and local governments and municipalities, and especially councillors who have to, at the end of the day, tell their constituents that yes, development is coming, and no, we can't charge as much for it as we have been and subsidizing your tax rates.
And that, I think, is where I think there would be some people that would part ways and they would say, hey, it's not so much subsidizing tax rates, it's the people who are profiting from the growth are paying for the growth. Is that a fair way to characterize it in your estimation?
I actually don't think that's a fair way to characterize it. So it's important to remember what development charges are and are not. So development charges were brought in 1987 under the David Peterson government. And then in 1997, we had the Harris government really scoped them in of what you could charge for, because under the original arrangement, essentially municipalities could charge for anything that was related to services in growth. What the Harris government did was in the 90s decided, okay, we're going to scope this in to here are the hard and soft services you are allowed to charge for. And really what these development charges were designed to do was, let's say you've already got an existing service and you know, okay, we need to buy another two fire trucks here because we're going to build a fire station up in the north end to meet this new subdivision. That's where those development charges come into play and help fund that financial outlay related to the growth. And so really the theoretical argument is growth pays for growth. But what we're actually seeing here is municipalities have been upping their development charges as much as possible. The reports that have been written don't differentiate based on the true costs of servicing. So, for example, here in the City of London, the same development charge is applied regardless of whether you're building downtown or you're building out in the periphery. So there's no difference between those development charges. But you, as a reasonable and logical person, would understand it's probably a lot less expensive to service growth in the downtown than it is growth out in the periphery.
Right.
And that's where the problem comes in.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I was talking about this with a friend of mine way into work this morning, and we were just discussing, he and I are both guys that live sort of in the core. And we were saying, like, okay, if someone wants to have some development charges waived for building a big, tall apartment building in the downtown, I'm willing to live with that. If someone wants to have some development charges waived for building something in the very far west end of the city that means that we need a whole bunch of new roads, new pipes, maybe a new fire station, then I'm willing to tell that person to pound salt. So I think it depends on where in the city we're talking about development as far as how I feel about the charges.
Yeah. And the other thing to remember, too, with property markets in Canada particularly, is we actually have a government-controlled financing system. So at the end of the day, the federal government, through the Bank of Canada, as well as their own lending policies, determine what customers at banks can afford and take out as a mortgage. And so when people say, you know, oh, if we get rid of development charges, developers aren't going to pass those savings along, well, that completely misunderstands the point of property markets themselves and sales. And what I believe actually will happen is when these development charges are reduced in specific cases, and I want to get into that because there's been a lot of misinformation actually pushed out by municipalities about what is affected by this bill and what is not. And really, at the end of the day, what will happen is when those development charges are dropped again on very specific cases, what you will see is developers will drop their prices because the lower the price is, the more customers will compete for that product. Right. And that's where, because we have this system that people have to get approval for a mortgage based on the federal government's rules, you don't have this raw, pure market competition. You actually want your prices as low as possible because the widest swath of customers can actually afford to purchase your product. Or rent it at the end of the day. That's the other thing is, you know, lower rents do come when you have greater supply. That is irrefutable evidence that we have across North America, that the more rental supply there is, the lower rents are.
Well, and I would very much agree with that. And I think that we should definitely have more rental properties, especially sort of in the already developed areas of the city. Let's talk about the, you mentioned messaging from various municipalities. Two off the top of my head. London City Hall staff there said that, hey, Bill 23 could cost us, what, $97 million over 5 years. Yeah. Bonnie Crombie in Mississauga tweeted this out earlier this week. The legislation will cost us, a direct quote from her tweet, legislation will cost the city of Mississauga $885 million over 10 years in development charge money and for new, and money for new parks. It's equal to losing 20% of our capital budget. Your thoughts on those numbers? Do you reject those numbers, or do you think that they're playing with them a little bit, or do you think there's something to what Bonnie Crombie or city staff here in London are saying?
So what the issue I take with those numbers is they assume and they position this issue as overnight they lose all this money and overnight they have no other revenue tools available to raise that funds. What I will remind people is if it's capital infrastructure, so it's not related to operations, municipalities have the full power to issue bonds and do debt financing. And it's what we used to do a long time ago before, you know, the 1989 shift in development charges. And really, actually, through the 90s, municipalities weren't using development charges as much of a financing tool. So really, on the capital infrastructure side, I don't put much water in that argument. $97 million in a bond issue or even $800 million in a bond issue amortized over 25 years is frankly peanuts at the scale of cities we're talking about. Now, where I take issue with this is I want to go over which developments are being exempted from these development charges, because I think that will change a lot of people's perspective about what we are losing, quote unquote. So what Bill 23 did was it exempted rental constructed by nonprofits and co-ops. So we used to actually charge the same development charge to nonprofit housing corporations that were building rental and co-op housing corporations. I think we can all agree that's probably not a great way to ensure affordability of those units.
Right.
Second, we're exempting affordable and attainable housing. So this is actually going to be defined by the Ministry of Municipal Affairs every year. They're going to set regionally what the average market value is for rent as well as the sale of a property. And then if a developer or a landlord leases that or sells it at 80% below that level, they're also exempt from development charges. Again, we're in a bit of a crisis right now, and people cannot afford to rent. They cannot afford to own. And there's some conditions here that the developer and the original landlord has to ensure that that rental unit in particular stays below market rent at 80% for 15 years minimum. So that ensures, you know, this really short-term supply that hopefully can address some of the crunch in some of our cities. The other things that I think, you know, people will agree with here is it exempts conversions of single detached dwellings into duplexes and triplexes. So right now we, again, charge the same development charge as a massive McMansion out in the periphery as we would if we converted something on Central into a duplex or triplex. I would argue that, you know, the material impact of converting a single detached to a triplex is nowhere
almost
near
zero,
almost negligible. Yeah. There is a little bit of impact. However, you now have, instead of one taxpayer,
three
taxpayers within that house. And so this is where, over time, that growth will be accommodated for in our tax base. And then the last thing that I think is really interesting, I just want to highlight, is municipalities also haven't really lost development charges. They've lost the ability to writ large charge them. There is still something called Section 37 under the Planning Act, and that's what's called a community benefits charge. And what municipalities can do actually is enter into an agreement with a developer and say, you're required to pay this amount of money per unit or for this development writ large to pay for an expansion of these services. And what's really fascinating about this government, and I think a win for municipalities, is you are now actually allowed to register these agreements on title. And what's really interesting about that is before this change, a developer could enter into an agreement and go belly up and bankrupt, and then the municipalities lost all that leverage and negotiating power. Now they can register that agreement on title, so whoever purchases that land and tries to develop it again has those conditions on the title associated with that property. And so that's where I think, you know, there's a really interesting pathway that has been created for municipalities. Now, on the sort of where these losses are coming from, one of the things the government has done, and I think it's frankly due to the fact that municipalities have, I think in the city of Toronto, it's been a tripling of development charges in the last decade. For the first 5 years after this act, in the first year, all development charges are discounted to 80%. Then the second year, 85%. Then the third year, 90%. And then the fourth year, 95%. And again, this is meant to provide immediate relief to the market and try and fix some of the pro forma financing on some developments that are teetering on the edge. And so I think, you know, we don't have the evidence here because we're trying things, because it's clear that the system itself is not working. And so I think in the next 1 to 2 years, we're going to see the effects of this policy change. And at the end of the day, I think it's going to be a net positive. And really, you know, municipalities, at the end of the day, can recoup all these losses if they just approve more housing and get more people in their cities. It's not a hard calculation at the end of the day.
Yeah, so I suppose if the government's plan here was to pressure for more development, that is what is going to happen. Of course, critics would also say, hey, they should have been a little bit more specific about what type of development we're talking about and where it is we want to go, i.e. that downtown apartment building that we're talking about where a whole bunch of people are going to live. That should be prioritized and that should be more encouraged than something on the edges of the city. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think, you know, municipalities need to do a better job of directing that growth and need to provide predictability. I mean, the fact that we had a six-story building this week at Planning Committee referred back to staff on Commissioner's Road. It's Commissioner's. You're telling me a six-story building is a problem on Commissioner's Road? I refuse to believe that, you know, decision was not entirely kowtowing to a little bit of resident pushback. And frankly, you know, the number of residents that showed up to that opposition aren't really even local property owners affected. They're just broadly neighborhood people who are concerned about this vague menace of traffic, which, again, it's Commissioner's Road.
Yeah. Like, what did you expect to happen on commissioners? It was the same thing. It was a conversation about traffic when we were talking about, I was watching a planning meeting. They were talking about a development. I think it was Wellington and Southdale. And like, oh, yeah, we don't want traffic around here. The mall is across the street. Like, what do you think is going to happen? Like, oh, we don't want traffic around here in December. I've got some bad news. People are going to show up to White Oaks Mall in December, whether there's an apartment building here or not. Like, it just, yeah, it doesn't make sense. It's the specter of traffic. But let's be honest as to what it is. I don't want anyone else living here. I just want to live here. And it's very much a NIMBY situation, and that's fine. It's not fine as far as how I feel about it, but it's fine as far as we can just be honest about what it is. So it's just a matter of councillors resisting that stuff, in your opinion, then.
Yeah, pretty much. I think, you know, at the end of the day, councillors have made their bed and they need to now lie in it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have some new councillors that I'm hopeful will come around to this idea of this city does need to grow. I think it's quite clear based on the population growth and the current rental market rates and, you know, just absolute gangbusters that the housing market has done in this city in the last 5 years. People want to live here. People are attracted to London. So let's harness that and get people in the right places and approve developments that are in the right areas. And I also want to point out that, you know, I think the expansion of the urban growth boundary can be done as long as it's very clear on what we're putting out there and that it's well designed, it's well thought out, and we don't end up with a situation like we're seeing right now in Summerside and Southdale of these massive subdivisions going in and an elementary school having more than 1,000 students when it was only built for 500. I think, you know, there's that aspect too of a lot of our development decisions have just not considered where existing services are. And you can't then, you know, try and correct that by charging up front every new property owner a development charge to recoup those poor decisions. I think at the end of the day, you know, the tax base has to shoulder some of the risk associated with these decisions. Now, I want to turn to some of the other Planning Act changes, because I think those are a little bit interesting too. One thing I want to highlight and emphasize for people, because I've seen a lot about it on social media, Bill 23 did not change the boundaries of the Greenbelt. That's a different piece of legislation. The public comment is actually open till December 6th. So if you go to the Environmental Registry of Ontario, anyone can comment on that. And that regulatory system actually is quite strong. There are pathways within the ministry that they would take that feedback into account and potentially adjust some of the proposed changes. And so this is where I really want to emphasize for people, if you are frustrated about the Greenbelt Act changes that are proposed, you still have time to get your voice in. And you should, because that process is integral to the functioning of the Greenbelt Act itself. It is centered around the idea of public comment and the idea of responding to public comment at the end of the day. Now, getting back to sort of some of the other changes here, I think, you know, one of the things that is great is that we now have, as of right, legalized triplexes anywhere in Ontario, which I think is huge for sort of this gentle density that we're talking about, of being able to get more people in existing neighborhoods without visually really changing much of the neighborhood. So I think that's going to be a huge win. I also think some of the changes we've seen on the Conservation Authority Act side really is an aspect of deduplicating the process. So what's been happening recently is you as a developer will go and get your zoning bylaw and development approvals, and then you have to go over to the Conservation Authority, which is the Upper Thames Regional Conservation Authority here. And all of a sudden, they're starting to comment on, well, how does this affect climate change long term? What are your material choices? How does this affect wildlife? But meanwhile, you dealt with that or will be dealing with that in your site planning process with the municipality. So why are we duplicating that process? And really, at the end of the day, when we go back to conservation authorities and what they are unique in North America. We are the only jurisdiction in North America that has something called a conservation authority, with the responsibility to protect life and protect slope stability.
Right.
It's a genius invention. It actually was a great policy initiative. The problem is there's been a lot of scope creep in the last two decades with what they're doing on the development side, and it really has slowed down a lot of the development process and duplicated a lot of the process with no real measurable impact on again, the core mandate of protecting life and protecting slope stability. And that, at the end of the day, I think is what this bill has done, is it has scoped those conservation authorities back into their original mandate, and it puts the onus back on the municipalities to actually act under their authority in the Planning Act. And so that's where I think, you know, the onus lies, and that's where the majority of the process should lie. The conservation authorities should really only be concerned when, in fact, there is an issue for flooding or there is an issue of a slope failing. So from that perspective, I think, you know, it's a much more positive change than what it has been made out to be. And I think it's actually going to result in a lot better outcomes and a lot more predictable outcomes over the long term.
Now, Mike Schreiner, who I have a lot of time for, leader of the Green Party,
yep.
He talked a lot about, you know, conservation authorities not liking this, and you sort of addressed that there. But he's of the belief, and the New Democrats are of the belief, that this is going to lead to more sprawl. It's going to lead to less infill development and more sprawl the way Bill 23 is set up. And you don't believe that to be the case? That's what you would say?
So I think where that's coming from is it's not the Conservation Authority Act changes that I think have me worried. I'm actually a little bit worried with this bill on the fact that it has removed regional planning control
right.
from some regions. So, for example, the region of Waterloo, Halton. Durham.
Peel,
yep. as well as one of them. And one of the issues, particularly in Waterloo, and it's actually a really interesting legal question that has not been answered yet. It's one that I think will be answered in the coming months, is the region of Waterloo has the countryside line. So similar to our urban growth boundary.
Yep.
So it is established limits around
I grew up in Waterloo, so I know generally where those lines are.
Yeah, yep. exactly. Now, those lines are based in regional bylaw.
Right.
What happens when you say, okay, the region of Waterloo no longer has planning control? Does the countryside line still exist because it's a bylaw that was duly passed by council? Or because we've completely removed the regulatory framework associated with it?
So if someone
does it just go poof?
If someone wants to build some giant subdivision, say, you know, outside of Baden or whatever it happens to be. I'm actually not sure where the
well,
regional
that's
line
that's a little
be.
Bit
yeah,
different.
Yeah. But just
let's say on the west side of Kitchener.
Sure, west yeah. side of Kitchener. Yeah, where actually I've got my brother and sister-in-law live on the west yeah. side of Kitchener. So there's some wooded areas not far from where they live. Someone wants to bulldoze one of those and build a big subdivision there. At some point, there would you would think we have to be a court date to figure out, hey, which of these two bylaws or which of these two planning rules are the yeah. Is the relevant one.
Exactly. And the other thing to remember, though, is the city of Kitchener and the city of Waterloo are completely within their right to pass a bylaw that establishes the same line again,
right.
if, in fact, this, you know, regional bylaw does go poof. Now, one of the other things, just to highlight for folks in rural areas, we actually have a different thing there called settlement areas. And what this is actually mini growth boundaries that form around built up areas within rural municipalities. And those municipalities actually can only expand their boundaries by applying to the ministry and showing that they do need more land and they are going to use it efficiently and it's not going to destroy existing Class A farmland or harm natural heritage integrity. And it's actually a very strict regulatory process that's done by the ministry. So for folks that are thinking, you know, there's going to be an issue with some of these changes, I haven't really seen anything in Bill 23 that screams to me, you know, beyond just this question of what happens to these regional growth boundaries, there's not going to be sprawl occurring in Baden or Elmira mm-hmm. or Lucan, for example. Well, on the other hand, I think, you know, there has been sprawl in Lucan, but
yeah,
that's from
Bill,
a different
Bill 20,
reason.
Yeah, Bill 23 is not allowing sprawl in Lucan. We've already been having that. That's, yeah.
Exactly. And so, but again, this is the thing of why that's happening in Lucan. Is because we have a broken development system here in the City of London. And what I like to tell people is for every story we cut off here in the city is a acre of farmland that's getting eaten up out in Lucan or in Thames Center, because that's where that growth will go. It has to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. And people will drive to qualify. People will spend an extra 30 minutes on the road if it means that they can purchase something at their price level. Right. And I think, you know, at the end of the day,
that's what we don't want them to do. We don't
exactly.
want them to spend that 30 minutes on the road.
No. And we also don't want that growth going up in Lucan and Thames Center because they're not on the same level of municipal services that we have. They're on a lot of wells and Oh, no. I'm forgetting the technical term for property-based sewer. Oh. It's a big pit. You dig.
Yeah.
Some pit. whatever that word is. I think, you know, from that perspective, there's a real issue with that. We're pushing all these this growth out into areas that aren't equipped to deal with it yet.
Yeah, and there's a few different elements to that as well. For starters, you are going to have a lot of people driving from those places into London to come to work. You are going to have a lot of people that are driving from those places into London to come use city services. And that's the other thing that I think gets a little bit under discussed, just because the services simply aren't the same in Thames Centre or in Lucan as they are in London. And that's fine. That's because London's a bigger place. But yeah, that's part of the deal. So I look at this at Bill 23 and think, hey, this could have been an opportunity to maybe fix some of those problems. You think that there's a chance that it's done that, or at least tried to address that in your estimation?
I think it addresses some of the fiscal side of things. Mm-hmm. One of the things on the Planning Act side that was a bit of a weird choice was they originally really tightly scoped third-party appeals. So essentially what that means is, you know, you get a zoning bylaw amendment or a development application approval and someone appeals you. Mm-hmm. And all it is $30 and you file a letter with the ministry and you have yourself an appeal. Which is an issue. So they really scoped it into, I believe it was only about 8 organizations. And so really what it was the major railways, the utilities, and I believe Ontario Hydro. Mm-hmm. Those were the only parties that under the original draft of the bill that were going to be able to appeal. And then over sort of the second and third reading and committee hearings, all of a sudden that all disappeared. And we reverted right back to anyone can pay $30 and do a third party appeal. And I think, you know, there was definitely room for a nice middle ground there.
Yeah.
Of, you know,
I would love to ditch that because just think about the time that's wasted with this stuff.
Well, and you know, the landlord tenant or the land tribunals of Ontario. Sorry, that name has changed so many times.
Yeah, it used to be LPAD. Oh, yeah, that's
LPAD,
where it is now.
LPAD, OMB. You know, it's been so many names in the last couple of years. Right now, there's about a 2-year delay just to get a hearing.
Right.
Because there's such a backlog, and we also. I will completely call out the government on this and many governments. Since the 90s, we have not been appointing the number of tribunal officers that we need in order to conduct hearings at an efficient rate. Right now, I think there is only 32 hearing officers for the entire province. 32. On the judges' side, we have close to 600 judges in the province of Ontario. And so, you know, you compare those numbers, you're relying on an entire province's development system, an appeal system, relies on 32 people.
Feels like that's not enough?
Feels like that's probably not enough to
get
some
work done. Feels like there should be 32 that work in Toronto.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, if you wanted an efficient, if you wanted to keep the appeal process and have an efficient process, you would hire more hearing officers. But I do think there is a solution of reducing how many appeals can happen. The other interesting thing that has happened is on the site planning side. So one of the things they've done is you no longer, or municipalities can no longer dictate to developers and builders, hey, we don't like that brick color, or mm-hmm. we don't like that siding choice, you need to change it. Or you need to break up the visual massing of your building. So
that is a good thing.
That, I think, you know, from my perspective, is a good thing. I have some colleagues who think it's a very negative thing, but I think, you know, it's important to remember planners are not architects. We are not urban designers.
No.
You know, my planning degree, I had one course in urban design, and it focused mainly on the actual components of site planning that matter of, you know, where do you put the entrance and exit to the property? Where do you put some barriers to protect life safety? How far do you push the building back to protect sight lines from the corner
and
to the corner?
And that stuff is fine.
Yeah.
But what color is the brick?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't care.
Exactly.
Like, I truly don't care. Like, if it's a safety thing, if it's something that, all right, we want to make sure people are able to see around this building if they're driving or walking or cycling, yeah, that's fine. We can talk about that. But what color are the bricks? I cannot imagine caring.
And what the government did, which was really good, is in the original draft of the bill, it completely deleted that section. Yeah. And what they did is they walked it back in the committee hearing, and it allowed municipalities to establish sustainable urban design guidelines. And those are a bit of a good thing when they're done right, because what they do is they protect wildlife safety, for example. So a huge issue right now in cities is you get these large buildings that with a lot of glass, and birds can't recognize that that's not something they can fly into.
Right.
So what you can require through those guidelines is particular materials or mitigation measures on that glazing for those windows to ensure that, you know, birds don't run into them head on, which I think is a good thing. But there's also things around life safety of ensuring that particular materials are stable and aren't going to collapse in 5 years, as well as, you know, some of the carbon intensity of certain materials. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're incredibly lucky in Ontario that we sit on some of the largest pit sand and gravel resources in the world. So it's incredibly cheap for us to make concrete. But there could be jurisdictions elsewhere outside of Ontario where, you know, you would actually want to tell developers, hey, let's maybe not build as much of this out of concrete because it's incredibly carbon intensive to get that concrete from its source to here. But, you know, here in London, we're actually quite lucky in that all our aggregate resources are available around us.
Yeah.
So
my mom lives in St. Mary's, and I say,
so, you know that.
Yeah, I've seen the pit. I know what's going on. I do want to remind folks that you do not have to go far to find Alexis, including going to Alexis of London. You can find them at 1065 Warncliffe Road South and online at lexusoflondon.com. They are, of course, the sponsors of this podcast. Luxury to find. You can pick out your new Lexus today at Lexus of London. I look at where we're at with some of the stuff. And just, there should be no debate that we need housing. We need housing fast. And we need housing that is already in places where people already live. You know, like I think that what I didn't care for from Bill 23 is I felt as though there wasn't enough guidance of you're going to build houses in your – not even necessarily houses, but you're going to build places to live in your downtown cores. And the neighborhoods that are going to get up in arms about this, that, or the other thing. I saw a Twitter thread where David Miller was, you know, defending certain Toronto neighborhoods as, you know, not being NIMBY neighborhoods. I don't know. You may have seen the thread.
I saw the annex thread.
Yeah, the annex.
It was
shocking. Like, it's just like, yeah, like, it like, and I wanted to tag you in the thread and be like, hey, this neighborhood reminds me of one in London, but I can't quite put my finger on which one it is.
NIMBY Field.
Yeah. So we can't just sit here and say, oh yeah, no, we're pro housing, just not at our neighborhood, because that happens in a lot of neighborhoods. So I feel like there needs to be laws to combat that, and maybe there was a missed opportunity here for that. And I get that, you know, municipalities are not going to be thrilled with the way this plays out, but we need more housing, we need it fast, and we need it to be in places where housing already exists.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, one of the things that is going to come out of this, and we still don't know what it's going to look like, because it has to go again through the Environmental Registry of Ontario process. It is open right now. So what the province has done through Bill 23, I believe there might be a different operating legislation that they've done. I know Bill 39 is under review that has some interesting provisions that still have not passed. But essentially what is happening there is we used to have two different types of provincial planning documents. There was the broad provincial policy statement, and then there was the growth plan, which was just in the greater Golden Horseshoe area. So London actually didn't fall in that. And it's because we had a former Liberal cabinet minister that used to sit in a London riding here that wrote her thesis on that London will never grow. And so we had a provincial cabinet minister in power for many years that told everyone at the cabinet table, oh, you don't need to worry about London. London will never grow. And now look at us. We are actually the second fastest growing Canadian metro in North America, just behind Kitchener-Waterloo by, I think it's 0.2%. Per year. So we are growing at an astronomical rate, and there's other places outside of the growth plan area that are growing at an astronomical rate. Places like Kingston, places like Peterborough. And so I think really from our perspective or this government's perspective is these provincial policy statement changes are opening up and saying, okay, we're not going to differentiate between Greater Golden Horseshoe and the rest of the province. We're actually going to consider across the province, where are these urban growth centers going to go? So that's where I think you're going to get what you've talked about of the province coming in and saying, okay, here's the core area of London. That's an urban growth center. Here's Masonville Mall. That's a growth center. Here's White Oaks Mall. That's a growth center. And then that provides provincial policy that municipalities are required to conform with long term. And so they're going to have to update their official plans and their zoning bylaws to reflect that the province is saying these areas are where we want you to grow.
Yeah, that, That's the way it's got to be. Like it's the way it's got to be. And I know that not everyone's going to like it. And I'm going to be talking about this with not this exact thing, but sort of the housing issues in the province next week with Jonathan Scott on this podcast as well. And he's a counselor out in Bradford. I know I'm going to have Mike Moffitt on, I think, in the new year. So just to get sort of the updates as far as how this is working, where this is going. And I know that you've seen a lot of Mike's work. But he's been screaming about this from the rooftops for a long time, that, hey, we have a real problem here. And it's time for municipalities and it's time for the province to actually come to grips with that real problem.
Exactly. And I think, you know, this bill really at the end of the day was a reckoning for planners and municipalities. It mm-hmm. was, you know, you have been messing around for two decades and now you're going to find out about mm-hmm. what has happened. And I actually think the bill didn't go far enough in certain respects. There were certain things that were identified in the Housing Affordability Task Force report that I think should have been dropped into this bill, but were not. So for example, four stories as of right in any built up area. I think that was a huge change that could have, you know, again, brought in this gentle density. For example, I live in Old South, mm-hmm. which, you know, there are certain NIMBY elements there. But actually, if you walk around Old South, there are a lot of apartment buildings yep. and triplexes, quadplexes that are just hidden. Mm-hmm. You don't even really see them. There's 30-story towers in Old South, or 28, that are sunk down, like they're in a lower plate, so that they don't have as high of a visual impact. You wouldn't even realize the density that's in that neighborhood. And so I think people need to understand that we already have neighborhoods like this, and they're actually quite pleasant places to live and desirable yeah. places that people want to live. And so
people want to live in Wortley.
Yeah, people love Wortley.
You can walk to stuff. Like it's convenient. Like, yeah.
Yeah. You can afford a range of housing. So yeah. For example, I'm a graduate student. I'm not exactly pulling in the dough every week. I'm able to afford living in Wortley. Now, I was able to afford living in Wortley in 2018. I think if I was coming into the city now, I would not, because just the way that rental rates have gone. But I think, you know, that proves that there are neighborhoods and there are models that we can emulate to essentially meet this need for more housing and also provide a range of housing types that people are able to live within their neighborhood. I mean, one of the other challenges that Mike's really identified is this idea of housing compression as well as housing delayed formations. And what's happening there is you get a bunch of people who want to stay in their neighborhood, so aging in place, and they're living alone in a massive four-bedroom house when really what they need is a one-bedroom walk-up in a triplex or a one-bedroom rental unit if they want that. And I think there's a lot of people that actually do want that. They want to get rid of their four-bedroom house, but they still, again, they want to live in their neighborhood. They have friends. They have mm-hmm. services. They want to stay there. And so we need to figure out how to create that supply to get people out of family-sized housing. Because one of the challenges, so on a personal note, my partner and I are looking to move in together in the next year. She's in Kitchener. I'm here in London. We both are renting right now. She rents a two-bedroom. I rent an oversized one-bedroom. We have been looking between here and Kitchener. We cannot find anything that is cheaper than the rent we are both paying right now together.
No.
And that is a real issue. So right now, you have a couple that wants to form a household and move into one unit to free up two units. And we can't.
That's too expensive.
And we can't. Because it's too expensive
that's
right
bizarre.
Now in the market. Because there isn't enough rental supply right. at the moment.
And so you're locked into a good rate that you got in 2018 and you exactly. can't afford to not have that.
Exactly. Why would I move when I'm paying $700 below market rate at the moment? Like that's a real incentive for me to stay. And again, on the flip side, there's not enough supply. So I actually can't find a unit that mm-hmm. fits for the two of us to be able to move into. So right now we're essentially, now you want to take that one example, multiply it 100 times and 1,000 times. Yeah. And now you understand why we have such a bad shortage right now of housing, yeah. because people can't get out of their current situations.
Yeah, I look at the example of, so on my street, there is a duplex across the street from me, which is fine. And the owners just renovated the whole duplex. It was recently sold. And so now it's two brand new sparkling units, new appliances, new blah, 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 new everything. It is, I think, $2,000 a month for one of the units and $2,200 a month for the other unit. I, living across the street, pay less than that in mortgage and property taxes combined.
And now we understand the crux of the problem.
Yeah.
Here. You know,
like, so that's just how out of control the rental market is.
Yeah. And I think, you know, from this side of these development charge exemptions and the requirement, again, that the landlord has to hold those units below 80% of market rent for 15 years is going to get a lot of people who are wanting to upgrade or wanting to upsize out of their existing units. And what that does is, I hate to use the term, it's trickle down of you get people, and it's not really trickle down, it's actually more dominoes falling.
Right.
Of you and I move up into larger units, or maybe you buy a larger house that you need for your family.
Sure.
And then all of a sudden your unit's now available. And then you get a bunch, and now again, multiply that by 100 or 1,000 times. And all of a sudden we have much more supply that can meet demand and actually, you know, potentially lower market rents. I mean, we saw it over the pandemic, actually. At one point in my building, units were being listed for $1,800, $1,900. 3 months after, you know, sort of the end of the major restrictions and when people were starting to be called back to offices, my landlord actually dropped the rent down again to $1,500. And so just like that, within 1 month, $300 lower. And so it is possible, because when demand falls and there is more supply, it's pretty basic that prices will come down, because the worst thing you can do as a rental landlord is hold a unit vacant. Mm-hmm. Because that is no revenue, and yet you still have to pay property tax. You still have to pay for servicing, because you have all your other tenants. So, I think there's a real problem there that we do need to increase supply to be able to bring down these rates.
And I know people, you mentioned you don't want to use the term trickle down. People roll their eyes at that, because look, we've talked about trickle down economics. Yep. That is not a real thing.
No.
However, that's because hoarding money is a real thing that people might do. Hoarding rental units, less so.
No, there's no financial incentive to
hoard
a rental unit. There is a financial incentive to hoard actual property that you purchase and hold it empty. And that's what we've seen in some condos in Toronto and other places. Now, what I will say is, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and this might be a certifiably hot take or spicy take
here. All right, let's go.
I think one of the biggest things the federal government could do to bring down the cost of housing is actually to eliminate the primary residence tax exemption. I think that because of the absolute gangbusters that has happened in the property market because of government intervention and government investment, that property owners being able to take that windfall completely, 100% of it, is fundamentally unfair to society writ large. And I think we could solve sort of two birds with one stone. One, it would be an incredible new revenue stream to be able to fund infrastructure, to be able to fund services, to be able to even fund healthcare. I think that's one of the challenges, is we're trying to figure out how to fund these very expensive national projects. On the other hand, it also would bring down the sort of fever we see around property, in that right now for a lot of Canadians, that is their retirement.
Right.
They are not saving for retirement. They are relying on their house in the annex or in Southdale or up in Masonville to increase 40 to 50% while they hold it. And that will be their retirement.
And right now that is working.
It is working. Clear. It is working, to be clear. Is it fair to a lot of people?
Perhaps less so.
Perhaps less so.
Would you not think that it might discourage people from moving then, if all of a sudden I have to pay taxes on the result of the sale of this house?
Well,
from downsizing, perhaps.
So I think that the proposals that have been considered is you would tax the gain that is related to the geographic change around your home.
Okay.
You would not tax if, let's say, you invested in your property. So a lot of people, they'll buy a house, they'll finish the basement.
Right.
Well, under this proposal, you would be allowed to deduct
whatever you put into the
whatever
basement.
You've put into that house, because you are materially increasing the value of that property. You have spent SWEC equity. You're not speculating.
Right.
And that's one of the biggest issues right now in the property market, is everyone right down to mom and pop are speculating about the value of their home, and the line must always go up. And that's the issue, is because we're so reliant on the property market for retirement and just general financing. I mean, the whole entire industry of reverse mortgages in your 60s and 70s to be able to fund your retirement based on just loaning out your house, I think, you know, fundamentally is causing issues writ large in that there's being less money put in on the capital market side, and a lot of money is being tied up in the property market itself, which could be used for more productive purposes.
Right.
So anyways, spicy take to consider, yeah. But I think, you know, there's definitely other options, and that I certainly would say is a much more aggressive proposal for how we resolve some of these really challenging issues. And again, full disclosure, I don't own a house. I would love to own one. And you know, I'm probably a little upset, like many other millennials, that I can't afford to buy one right now. I don't have the same opportunities that my parents had.
Yes, that is a fact. And I feel very fortunate as someone who is right in the millennial wheelhouse as far as my year of birth goes that I've been able to do that. But I entered the workforce at the age of 22, and you know, most people don't do that, and there's a whole bunch of different things. Anyway, before we wrap up, this is something that I think that the Ford government's going to get a lot of pushback from municipalities on. Obviously, I've seen a lot of London councillors, you know, be at protest for this, and even some London councillors that, again, you would think would be aligned with the Ford government on a lot of issues, and I referenced Paul Van Meerbergen earlier, saying, hey, this is probably not necessarily the way to go about this. The Ford government has in the past, as we have seen with use of the notwithstanding clause against educational assistants or early childhood educators, or with, you know, closing parks in April of 2021, they've been in a situation where they've realized that the stove is too hot to touch, and they've brought their hand back real quick. Do you think there's a possibility of that here? I originally thought yes, but the more I thought about it, I'm thinking that the answer might be no, from the perspective of enough Ontarians are not going to care about it. People care about parks. People care about who's teaching their kids. Less people care about how the property tax base gets sorted out. What do you think?
So again, you've hit the nail on the head. I actually think this government is not really conservative. It's an incredibly populist government.
Right.
And they like to throw their hand on the stove and see how hot it can get before they decide whether or not they're going to leave it there. And I think in this case, I don't actually see much, you know, populist revolt against Bill 23. Because at the end of the day, the changes that we're going to see from this are going to be decades in the making.
Right.
These are long-term changes. And I also think, you know, the municipalities that have been positioning this is, your taxes are going to have to go up. At the end of the day, I think one of the projections was in Mississauga, all it was going to take was a $75 a year increase. Right. Over the next 5 years, which, you know, nobody likes their taxes going up, but not sort of the doom and gloom financial cliff that it was being made.
Yeah,
out
if
to
London's
me.
At $97 million over 5 years, I'm trying to think about what that would be to the average home. I'll get someone to math that out with the city for me, but it's not going to be a massive amount of money. Yeah. You'll notice it though.
Exactly. And now, where I think there is a chance for this government to walk back is definitely on the Greenbelt tax side.
Yeah.
I think, you know, those changes. There's going to be a lot of the public that are passionate about that because the Greenbelt is a symbol.
And there's going to be accusations of corruption there.
Absolutely. Now, what I will say is I agree with Minister Clark on seeing that where those lands have been taken out, there are some pretty logical reasons for some of them. So, for example, the ones in Pickering that have come up quite a lot. What's really interesting about those is they are right under the main York to Durham region sewer main.
Right.
So there's this massive sewer main that a lot of people don't know was being built over the last two decades between York region and Lake through Durham region. And so those lands essentially sit right on top of that. There's a 407 interchange right there. If you were going to bring any land into the GTA from the Greenbelt, that would be technically where you want to do it. Now, on the side of who's benefiting from these decisions, I think, you know, there's some questionable property deals that were made. However, what I will say is being charged a 21% interest rate is an indication that the bank really doesn't believe you're holding the cards you claim you do. I think that's going to be the determination, is who knew what at what stage, and were some of these people got advance wind that, you know, land was coming in to the growth area, but didn't know where, and so just decided to roll the dice and you know, put it forward.
You mentioned roll the dice. The comparison I made was if you're at the casino and you've taken out this big loan to play roulette and you put all the money on, you know, red 35. I don't even know if 35 is right. I don't play a lot of roulette. I'm more of a blackjack guy. But you put all the money on red 35 and comes up red 35. People are going to say, hey, wait, hold on a second. Did you know it was going to be red 35 somehow? Because it feels as though like it wasn't necessarily roulette spin that decided where this land was coming available. It was something a little more specific.
Exactly. And I think one of the other things to remember is a lot of these families or development companies mm-hmm. have billions of dollars in the ability to capitalize on their investments. So, you know, it might seem ridiculous to the average person that someone would spend $120 million on a piece of property. But when you consider their broader portfolio, $120 million is actually an average investment in a piece of property, especially if you are rolling the dice and thinking this is going to come within the growth boundary and I am going to be able to build on it, or, you know, knowing how this province is going. Again, the Greenbelt Act was not set up to be sort of this permanent boundary forever and ever and ever. It was designed to signal to developers, this is the extent of the growth that you're going to have for the next 20 years. After this, you know, we might consider an expansion if, again, it makes sense from a servicing and infrastructure perspective. But one of the issues I want to highlight for folks, and I really want you to, I'm going to tell folks, go into Google Street View and go tour around the lands they're proposing to bring into the Greenbelt, because the Greenbelt Act requires if you're going to take lands out,
you got to put the same in.
Yeah. The lands they're proposing to put in Halton are actually really laughable, because what it is a lot of people don't realize the Greenbelt actually has had a phenomenal amount of development happen within the last 10 years, because what's been happening is people are buying up an old farm and then building a massive 4,000 square foot mansion on the property. But because it's, you know, still a farm,
single family home and a farm. And
exactly. It still meets the rules of the Greenbelt Act. But go look at that property in Halton and tell me the ecological integrity of that property or the farming that is being done in that area. It's quite interesting to see, you know, that is an area that was in the Greenbelt and fundamentally is just a very rich suburb.
Right. With a lot of space in the property.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's interesting. By the way, 35 is black. I just wanted to be clear.
35 is black.
Yeah, there we go. So you bet all the money on black 35. That's fine. So I think that the issue with the Greenbelt thing is going to come out from, like we said, hey, wait a minute. Who knew what when? And is this government, will they have been sloppy enough that people will have known stuff before they should have known stuff and made big bets on and wound up getting paid? What might save them is if there are some other developers who made the same bets in the Greenbelt that may also be, you know, tied to the Ford government some way, who lost their big bets. If that, and I don't know if that's happened yet. No one's come out and said, "Oh man, I spent $100 million in this property that hasn't been that we can't do development on." If that's something that happened, that might save them a little bit.
Well, and again, because we don't have a public transaction record like some jurisdictions in North America, there's no way to actually confirm whether or not there were transactions occurring before this announcement with people also rolling the dice and, as you said, now have lost everything.
Yeah. But if it came up black 35, yeah. Is there someone who put all their money on red 4?
Yeah. And we're thinking red 4 was coming in, but red 4 did not. And one of the things I also want to highlight for folks is, yes, there are about 8 families in Toronto that own a phenomenal amount of property. However, some of those properties, particularly the ones in Pickering, have been owned for decades. They have been speculating and sitting on those lands for decades. And so the mere, you know, presence of their properties within the areas that have been brought in does not mean there was some nefarious plot there just by default. I think, you know, at the end of the day, you really need to look at, okay, how long have they owned those properties? What other properties do they own? I think, you know, the highway decision, again, it's getting Highway 413, it's getting routed through a bunch of people's lands. But again, a lot of these families have owned those lands for a number of years, hoping and thinking one day, you know, I'm going to be able to build on these eventually. And I think that's where there certainly are deals that have raised red flags for me, particularly the one out in sort of the Hamilton area. That's the the massive one with the 21% interest rate. That's the one I have a lot of questions about. But some of the other lands, I'm like, these, again, are seem to be very evidenced of if, again, you were going to take lands out of the Greenbelt, this is where you would probably do.
Right. So. Yeah. And yeah, the 21% isn't like that's the one that is the red flag for me, too, because like who takes out a loan for $100 million at 21% and let like how do you like that's a lot of interest. How do you know how you're going to pay this back? Like, you know,
I can't remember
if it was you, but somebody responded to me like, OK, did somebody put this on Amex? Like, how does that work? Like, you know,
that was not me.
Oh, OK. are you getting like Aeroplan points out of this? Yeah, like, how, you
know, like, knowing what bank they loaned it out of, maybe they're getting their RBC points and their CIBC Avion rewards.
Yeah, no, I was able to fly to Tahiti on this. It's fine. That's the one where I think there's going to be some questions. I guess we'll see how that goes. But yeah, like you said, this is it's two separate conversations between what Bill 23 is and what this whole mess is. And yeah, I think that it'll be interesting to see if this becomes another stove that's too hot to touch for them from the perspective of they probably have some people that are going to be really pressuring them from the inside to say, hey, this can't be a stove that's too hot to touch because I've already bet $100 million on this and I thought I already won my bet. You can't tell me I've now lost my bet. Because that will be an awkward conversation.
Well, and I think, you know, at the end of the day with this bet, these bets is, you know, again, property markets are an inherently risky investment.
Yes.
They're not a safe investment. So, again, somebody might have just lucked out. Somebody also might have lost their shirt. But, you know, just to wrap up here on Bill 23, what I want to highlight for folks is, again, we are in very early days. There were a lot of changes actually within Bill 23 that allow the minister to make regulations with cabinet authority. Instead of it, you know, being completely prescribed in the act, it now is within a regulation. So they're much more nimble and able to change the conditions around those regulations. And that can be both a good and a bad thing when it comes to legislation. So I think, again, we're very early in what Bill 23 will do. And I think, you know, we have a government that, again, has made some really interesting decisions some days and has decided to touch very screaming hot rocks and realize that maybe we shouldn't have grabbed them. But at the end of the day, I think this government also is reasonable from the perspective of when there is enough public fury and there is enough pushback, they do walk back on their decisions. And I think that's where we might see further amendments in the coming years related to this bill. So.
Yeah, I think that's a good spot to leave it. AJ, thank you very much for coming in. I appreciate the time. It was a good conversation. And I did not know that we were going to be chatting for an hour, but we did, and that's okay with me.
All right. Well, this will make a good podcast.
You know what? This is going to make a good podcast, and I appreciate that. That's AJ Ray joining us here on the Craig Needles Podcast, and he's a PhD candidate at Western University, talking about Bill 23, talking about some Greenbelt stuff and all sorts of other fun things. Do want to remind you that the Craig Needles Podcast is brought to you by Lexus of London. Lifestyle with a drive. Your new Lexus is patiently waiting at the award-winning Lexus of London. You can find them at 1065 Warncliffe Road South and online at lexusoflondon.com. More of the Craig Needles Podcast coming up tomorrow. We've got the Friday Roundtable. Hollywood Cheryl Miller is going to be here, you know, assuming that she hasn't been canceled. And Nathan Caranti going to be here as well. And so it's going to be a good conversation. Looking forward to chatting with them tomorrow here on the Craig Needles Podcast and the Friday Roundtable. Have a wonderful rest of your day.